Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Tad Tobey, and I'm privileged to serve as president of the Corrett Foundation, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Directors, and your chair for tonight's program. Tonight's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's American Values series, underwritten by the Corrett and Tobey Family Foundations. Before I introduce our distinguished speaker, I am honored to let you know that tonight's moderator for the audience question period will be George Shultz, former U.S. Secretary of State and distinguished fellow at the Hoover Institution. Secretary Shultz, in addition to serving in a number of cabinet posts, was, of course, President Reagan's Secretary of State from 1982 to 1989, where he played a key role in implementing foreign policy that led to the successful conclusion of the Cold War. And now it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's esteemed speaker, Abraham Sofir, the first George P. Shultz Distinguished Scholar and Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and author of his new book, Taking on Iran, which is available in electronic form on the internet at scribdscribed.com. Before I proceed with my introductions of Judge Sofir, I would like to take note of the distinguished guests like Secretary Shultz and Judge Sofir that the Commonwealth Club has been bringing to its public forums for over 100 years. Abraham Sofir served as legal advisor to the U.S. Department of State from 1985 to 1990. He was the principal negotiator in various matters that were successfully resolved, including the dispute between Egypt and Israel over Taba and the claim against Iraq for its attack on the United States ship Stark. He received the Distinguished Service Award in 1989, the highest State Department award ever given to a non-civil servant. Professor Sofir's work has focused on the separation of powers issues in the American system of government, including the power over war, and on issues related to international law, terrorism, diplomacy, national security, and the Middle East conflict. During Judge Sofir's distinguished career, he has also been a prosecutor, a legal educator, a judge, government official, an attorney in private practice. In 1979, he was appointed the United States District Judge for the Southern District of New York, where he served until 1985. From 1969 to 1979, Professor Sofir was a professor of law at Columbia University School of Law, during which time he wrote War, Foreign Affairs, and Constitutional Power, an authoritative historical account of the constitutional powers of Congress and the President to control or affect the use of force. Today, he teaches a course on transnational law at the Stanford Law School and serves as my colleague and director of the Corrett and Tobey Foundations. Please give a warm Commonwealth Club welcome to Abraham Sofir.
Good job.
Okay. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm grateful to the Commonwealth Club for inviting me to discuss my new book, Taking on Iran. Thank you, George Dobbins, for your help in arranging this meeting, and Gloria Duffy, for your leadership of this important forum. My thanks as well to Tad Tobey for his introduction and for the support he gives to so many good causes in this wonderful city of San Francisco. My debt to George Shultz is profound. From the very first day I heard his name, Secretary Shultz has influenced my thinking and my life. That was in 1983, when he gave a speech that called for an active defense against terrorism. It was clear to me even then that he was bringing about revolutionary change in strategic thinking to match the development of what we now call asymmetric warfare. 2 years later, I found myself serving as Secretary Shultz's legal advisor, and 4 days after my swearing in, Hezbollah, Iran's surrogate terrorist force in Lebanon, hijacked TWA 847. For the next 5 years, I worked primarily in two areas, the U.S.-Soviet confrontation, leading ultimately to the collapse of the Soviet Union and the freedom of all Europeans, and the war that terrorists and their sponsors, notably Iran, have waged on the U.S. and others. Excellent results were achieved in the U.S.-Soviet relationship, as you all know. President Reagan, and after him, President George H.W. Bush, helped overcome Soviet aggression through determined resistance combined with consistent diplomacy. At no point did they explicitly call for regime change in the Soviet Union. Yet, that is ultimately what their efforts helped bring about. The outcome in responding to terrorism has been far less satisfactory, as we so terribly experienced in the attacks on the U.S. launched by al-Qaeda, and as we can see today in dealing with the Iranian threat. The latest multilateral negotiation with Iran has failed, and the world is waiting to see if the oil embargo scheduled to take effect a few days from now, together with financial restrictions, will create enough pressure on Iran to get it to agree to measures that would establish that it does not intend to develop nuclear weapons. I hope the sanctions succeed, but I doubt they will. Two of Iran's biggest customers, China and India, are not signed on to the embargo, and other leakage seems certain to occur. Iran is determined to proceed with a nuclear program, and its population is solidly behind this policy, which began under the Shah. Even if Iran feels enough pressure to want to continue to negotiate, little evidence exists that it will agree to the limitations being advanced as public demands in the context of the type of negotiation presently being conducted. If the P5 plus 1, the permanent five members of the Security Council plus Germany, fails, if that negotiation fails, and Iran goes ahead with nuclear enrichment and other testing, the U.S. seems poised to decide between two highly risky alternatives: preventive strikes on Iran's nuclear program, or attempting to contain a nuclear-armed Iran. Preventive strikes will be regarded as unprovoked and therefore illegal and illegitimate. They may cause serious damage to non-combatants and result in Iranian solidarity and an effort to speed up the nuclear program. Iran may also respond by escalating Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps aggression against the states that launch preventive strikes, which are in any event likely to be futile, given what Iran already knows. Establishing security in the Gulf, if Iran decides to attack U.S. Navy vessels, will be costly. Now, containing a nuclear-armed Iran would also be risky. Perhaps more so even than launching preventive attacks. Iran with nuclear weapons may be prepared to take greater risks in attempting to achieve its objectives in the Gulf, intervening in Bahrain, for example, or supporting allies like Assad in Syria or Hezbollah in Lebanon. Iran may even take the chance of supplying a nuclear device to a surrogate with which to attack Israel, regardless of the consequences. It is still an open question whether Iran can be deterred and how much pain it is prepared to inflict on its own population to achieve openly declared objectives that are blatantly illegal and disturbingly irrational. Even a low prospect of a catastrophic event could pose a risk some leaders may be unable to accept. Most analysts also believe that if Iran acquires nuclear weapons, other states in the region will want them, including Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, perhaps also Bahrain, Egypt, and Jordan. The proliferation of nuclear weapons in the area will create huge risks of mismanagement and miscalculation, far more complex and difficult to handle successfully than the U.S.-Soviet confrontation. Taking on Iran, my book, I put it out electronically in order for it to be relevant to the debate that continues today, presents an option to both preventive attack and containment. It assumes that the best, perhaps the only, way to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons is, as former Defense Secretary Gates believes, to convince Iran not to develop them. This may still be possible through a combination of increased pressure and more effective diplomacy. The U.S. can increase the pressure on Iran by doing what it should have been doing for the last 30 years, defending its soldiers, nationals, and interests from IRGC, Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, sponsored attacks and terrorism, in order to deter such attacks and in order to enhance U.S. credibility. The IRGC has for some 30 years, after bombing the U.S. Embassy and Marine barracks in Lebanon, been using surrogate attacks and terrorism against the United States with virtually complete impunity. And chapter 2 of my book is an account of the literally dozens of such attacks on Americans. Recently, it brazenly attempted to assassinate Saudi Ambassador Adel Al-Jubeir in Washington, D.C., in an operation that would have killed many civilians. Unlike preventive attacks, limited uses of force that respond to IRGC aggression would be legally defensible and could be implemented without the dangers of widespread collateral consequences. Attacks on IRGC bases and operations would not unify the Iranian population with its government as preventive attacks would. Since the IRGC, including especially its Basij force, or morality force as it's called, is feared and widely regarded within Iran as corrupt and reckless. Iran is also much less likely to escalate IRGC aggression or rush to develop nuclear weapons if the U.S. acts defensively against actual provocations by the IRGC. To the contrary, available evidence indicates that Iran would respond to firm defensive actions as it has to prior demonstrations of U.S. strength by seeking rather than giving up on engagement. and my book describes at least three instances in which Iran did seek greater engagement after the U.S. demonstrated greater strength. Now, while increased strength and the pressure it would provide is indispensable to successful diplomacy, as Secretary Shultz has repeatedly taught us, it is not alone sufficient. The U.S. must also change its negotiating strategy by adopting effective diplomatic practices, specifically those it applied in negotiating with the Soviet Union in the 1980s. Some believe that negotiating with Iran is fundamentally different from negotiating with the Soviets, requiring different practices. They are wrong. U.S. negotiating practices in dealing with the Soviets were not some sort of gesture extended to the Soviets as a mark of respect or friendship. They reflected our best judgment on how to represent the U.S. effectively by increasing the prospects of securing agreements that advance U.S. interests. These same objectives should guide U.S.-Iranian diplomacy, and the refusal to apply practices calculated to achieve them has guaranteed failure. Here are a few examples that illustrate the utility of applying to U.S.-Iranian negotiations five important diplomatic practices that the U.S. applied in negotiating with the Soviets and which are discussed at length in my book. First, rhetorical restraint. President Reagan insisted that the U.S. not crow, that was his word, when it was successful in convincing the Soviets to release dissidents or take some other step the U.S. wanted, but which could make the Soviet leadership look weak domestically. The same concern applies to Iran. Its leaders are under pressure within Iran to refuse to give in to U.S. demands. Comments by U.S. government officials claiming a negotiating victory made it impossible for President Ahmadinejad to stand by his agreement to swap most of Iran's low-enriched uranium for material that would have been usable only for medical purposes. It makes just as much sense to help Iranian negotiators find ways to do what the U.S. is seeking without making them appear to be capitulating, as it did to help Soviet leaders deal with that problem. Second, regime engagement. Ronald Reagan made no secret of the fact that he despised the Soviet system of government, what he called the evil empire. And he wanted it to collapse, the sooner the better. But he engaged the communist regime as a sovereign state entitled to established immunities and appropriate diplomatic treatment. The U.S. could not have negotiated successfully with the Soviets if it openly espoused regime change in the manner so casually done with Iran. We can criticize, even scorn, Iran for supporting terrorism abroad and religious oppression at home. But we cannot expect to negotiate effectively if we refuse to treat Iran as a sovereign state for purposes of diplomatic engagement. Third, limited linkage. Is the practice established by Secretary Shultz in response to the reality that the Soviets regularly did horrible things? Negotiating with the Soviets would have been impossible if we had linked our willingness to talk to them without having them behave well. The U.S. did all it could to embarrass and hold the Soviets accountable for each aspect of its misconduct. But we did not stop talking to them about disarmament, freedom, human rights, trade, and other issues. With Iran, we have used linkage as our response to IRGC misconduct. Instead of responding in kind to IRGC aggression, the U.S. has refused to talk, which does nothing to deter the IRGC, but does deprive the U.S. of the benefits of potentially useful negotiations. The clearest example of this was when, after promising to deal in goodwill with whoever got our hostages released from Lebanon, George H.W. Bush administration simply refused to deal with Rafsanjani after he worked very hard to get those hostages released. Not only did the U.S. miss an opportunity to attempt to change the U.S.-Iranian relationship, refusing to talk to Iran, damaged Rafsanjani's domestic standing and increased the IRGC's influence. Fourth, a broad agenda. U.S. negotiations with the Soviets succeeded in part because each side was permitted to put issues on the table for discussion. The U.S. did not make the implementation of agreements on all the issues the Soviets wanted to discuss conditional on Soviet acceptance of the U.S. position on any particular issue. The parties were therefore able to work on four baskets of issues and to emerge from every meeting with agreement on some matters and progress on others, creating the momentum that successful negotiations require. The P5 plus one, on the other hand, have offered to grant a number of Iranian demands and needs, but only after Iran agrees to accept their position on the nuclear issues. Iran is skeptical that it will ever receive the quid pro quo it has been promised, and by failing to allow any progress to be made in the negotiations through implemented agreements on such matters as the settlement of claims, removal of restrictions on commerce, and WTO negotiations, the West precludes the strengthening of the constituency within Iran that supports reconsidering its strategic objectives. Fifth and finally, the P5 1 plus 1 forum is likely to continue to be ineffective as the sole vehicle for negotiating with Iran. Meetings of the P5 plus 1 and Iran are announced in advance, with each side promising publicly to hold out for what the other side promises it will not accept. Each side then confirms after the meetings that it has maintained the demands of the other side, the demands that the other side promised it would never accept. Iran no doubt regards this process as a way of increasing the prospects for enhanced sanctions. That's not necessarily a bad thing, as sanctions increase the pressure on Iran to reach a negotiated solution. But it is essential also to provide other fora for discussions in which the parties can, without posturing, craft solutions to specific problems in confidence, as the U.S. and Soviets did in dealing with each other. Useful discussions have taken place between the U.S. and Iran in The Hague, where starting in 1985 through 1990, while I led those negotiations, we had many productive results. And the U.S. should utilize those, as well as the negotiations concerning Afghanistan and Iraq, which were very successful encounters with Iran, as the kinds of opportunities to engage Iran in meaningful talks. The program I am advocating would, I know and I acknowledge, require a major shift in the U.S. approach in dealing with Iran. But that should not be surprising to any intelligent person. The U.S. has tried to deal with the Iranian threat without taking Iran seriously as a sovereign state, whose excesses must actually be confronted, not merely wished away with idle rhetoric about regime change, and with whom a diplomacy must be conducted that is calculated to achieve the resolution of the full array of issues that exist between the states, not merely public displays of verbal toughness periodically interrupted by ill-considered appeals for new beginnings, such as the Iran-Contra affair, the Clinton speeches through Madeleine Albright, and the Obama appeal on Iranian New Year. The shift would be substantial, but the place we need to be is familiar. The U.S. knows how to stand up to serious threats to U.S. security, and it knows how to negotiate effectively. Henry Kissinger summed this up really so well that I must quote from his statement in 2006. Focusing on regime change as the road to denuclearization confuses the issue, he wrote. The U.S. should oppose nuclear weapons in North Korea and Iran, regardless of the government that builds them. The diplomacy appropriate to denuclearization is comparable to the containment policy that helped win the Cold War. No preemptive challenge to the external security of the adversary, but firm resistance to attempts to project its power abroad and reliance on domestic forces to bring about internal change. It was precisely such a nuanced policy that caused President Ronald Reagan to invite Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev to a dialogue within weeks of labeling the Soviet Union as the evil empire. That meeting and that invitation was issued pursuant to the recommendation of our great friend, Secretary of State George Shultz. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Our thanks to Abraham Safir, the George P. Shultz Distinguished Scholar at the Hoover Institution, and author of the new book, Taking on Iran. I'm George Shultz, and I'm your moderator for tonight's question period. And we've got a big stack of questions here. Not surprisingly, some have to do with Israel. How long do you think Israel is going to wait before it decides it has to do something about Iran?
I think that...
That's one of the easy ones here.
Yeah. There's a debate going on within Israel over whether people should be honest about the complications of attacking Iran or whether they should act like it's a cinch and it's all going to go very well and Israel's going to be able to do it. I think the fact of the matter is that the Israeli national security experts are well aware of how complicated and difficult a preventive attack on Iran would be. And I think that they will not act until there is no other option.
That sounded like a cop-out to me. Okay, here's another one. After we've seen all of these revolutions in a variety of Arab countries, and we saw one in Iran that got put down, do you think there might be another one similar to what's been going on in Egypt, Tunisia, Syria now? What do you think?
I don't think so, not in Iran. The Iranian experts that I've read about and know. Abbas Milani, for example, at Stanford and others, feel that at this point at least, the Basij force and IRGC have the country by the throat, and anyone who goes out to negotiate students in universities gets killed or imprisoned for long periods of time. It's a very serious tyranny right now.
Now, here's another one. You remember, Abe, during the Cold War, we managed to persuade Saudi Arabia to pump a lot of oil. And the price of oil for a sustained period was below the cost of producing it in the Soviet Union. And I remember one poignant exchange between President Reagan and Secretary General Gorbachev. He asked Gorbachev, "How come you're not buying any grain?" Gorbachev said, "We don't have any money." So why don't we work harder to find alternatives to oil and also encourage all of the prospects for producing oil here and get the price down? Why not do that as part of our effort?
That sounds like a George Shultz statement.
Well, that means you like it.
I like it.
Okay. This one is asking you, how precisely do we go about responding to the IRGC actions? Be a little more specific about what you would do.
There are IRGC bases in the Gulf. I give you the example of our Navy. We're honored to have Admiral Ruffhead here tonight, who was a CNO until this last year, who's now at Hoover, I'm very proud to say. The Navy, our Navy in 87 and 88, took on the Iranian Revolutionary Guard speedboats and other ships in the Gulf and did a marvelous job and in a matter of a couple of days sank half the Iranian Navy. That did not lead to a breakdown in talks at all. That led the Iranians to have me come back to The Hague even sooner. They wanted to see me. And they stopped mining the Gulf, and they stopped attacking Kuwaiti U.S. flagged vessels. So I think that's the kind of thing we need to do. When Iran sets up, when the IRGC sets up bases alongside of the border of Iraq and gives equipment to Sadrs in Iraq to kill American soldiers, we should have taken out those bases. And when the Saudi ambassador, when an effort was made to kill the Saudi ambassador by the IRGC, and the reason for that is very amusing, George, you'll appreciate this. It relates to a leaked cable pursuant to the WikiLeaks situation where the ambassador was recorded by a U.S. diplomat as telling the U.S. as they broke up from the meeting, "Don't forget that King Saud said, with regard to Iran, to cut off the head of the snake." And that was in that cable, and the Iranians saw it when WikiLeaks published it, and that put the ambassador's life in jeopardy. But what I would have done instead of indicting the members of the IRGC and the Quds Force, who are named by the U.S. Treasury Department, we know who they were. Instead of indicting them, we should have used one of the targeted killings that we are using for other enemies that try to kill people in the United States and are beyond the reach of our law.
What about cyber attacks on Iran's nuclear program?
I think they have set back the program marginally. The problem with cyber attacks is that people learn how to do them, and then they do them to us. And if you think the Iranians have any shortage of bright young people who know about the cyber world, you're mistaken. So I think it's a very short-term solution.
Iran's leadership, I'm reading this, may be autocratic and radical, but not suicidal. Why is it that you think containment would not work?
Containment might work. It worked with the Soviet Union. It worked with China. But I don't know that it will. And I don't know that a prime minister of Israel could live with the possibility that it would not work, because a single nuclear device that goes off in Tel Aviv would essentially replicate the Holocaust. So it's a very difficult situation to rely on containment. It is definitely an option. The president said he has no containment policy, but when the election's over, he may find one.
But you're saying there isn't one.
I don't think it's a safe policy. I don't think so.
What would world reaction be like to a limited bombing attack, so one that you describe, by the U.S.? How do you think the world would regard that?
I think Iran would regard as reasonable an effort by the U.S. to defend itself against an actual provocation by the IRGC. And I think because the Iranian leadership is rational, they would treat that as, in the very cold-blooded way in which they treated our naval attacks in 1988, where Mike Armacost, was Under Secretary of State at the time, told me not to go back to The Hague to continue my negotiations with the Iranians. I got a telephone call from them asking me why I wasn't coming back. I said, because you guys are mining the Gulf and we just started a war with you, you know, limited war. But and they said, oh, that's, you know, that's fine. We didn't mine the Gulf, and you're wrong about that, but that's separate. You know, come talk to us. We've got things to work on. That kind of sang-froid, as I think the French call it, is characteristic of Iranian diplomacy. And we should understand that they will understand our defending ourselves. What they will not understand, and what they might not understand at all, is an all-out attack on a nuclear program that hasn't even produced a nuclear weapon.
I'm uncomfortable with that phrase. It hasn't even produced a nuclear weapon.
Okay, hasn't yet produced a nuclear weapon.
Well, they're enriching uranium at a scale that's way, way, way beyond anything they could conceivably use for peaceful purposes, doing reactors. So what's it for?
I think they're definitely preparing for the option of making a nuclear bomb.
Here's a question about the strategy of responding, as you were talking about. The question is, what type of buy-in would the U.S. seek from Middle East allies? Would we you recommend that we go about getting some buy-in before we act, or how would you go about that?
I think that would be essential, and it would be very, very easy to bring about, because they're urging us on rather than telling us to stop. The Saudis have offered to put out as much oil as we need to get through the embargo on Iranian oil. And I think the other, particularly the Sunni states, and including Turkey, of course, would be very welcoming of firmness, increased firmness vis-a-vis Iran.
Here's a question about an article that was in the Foreign Affairs magazine, probably the most prominent magazine in foreign affairs, by the name of a man named Kenneth Waltz.
Yes.
He wrote in the latest arguing that if Iran had the bomb, they wouldn't use it for the same reason that others have not used it, and that the Middle East would be more stable. Do you buy his argument?
I certainly don't. Ken Waltz is a very clever guy who's this is his argument. He's been making it in other contexts. And Scott Sagan went head-to-head with him on the issue of whether it would improve security in Asia for more states to have the bomb, he took the position that it would. And Scott Sagan, who I respect much more than I do Ken Waltz, took the position that it would not. And I think he greatly understates the risks of mismanagement, not just miscalculation. When you have nuclear devices and a nuclear bomb program, you've got a whole lot of dangerous things going on. And he uses the Pakistan-India analogy. I think it's a very dangerous analogy to use because probably that is one of the great dangerous hotspots of the world today, the fact that both of them have nuclear weapons.
And I might say both are very conscious of that. We've had India-Pakistan high-level people come to Hoover and have conversations with them. And you talk on the side and you say, what's your biggest worry? And they say, nuclear war. That could happen very easily. If somebody that one of the countries really can't control, say, produces another Mumbai in India, it's unlikely that the Indian government would be as restrained as they were with Mumbai number one. And then you get started on something that unwinds. So I agree with you. This is a question about negotiating style. Let me precede it by explaining to people. There have been references to the negotiations that Abe conducted when he was legal advisor, but it's like this. There is something called the Iranians Claim Court in The Hague, where we have claims on them, they have claims on us, and it gets adjudicated. So I appointed Abe to be our representative. So here's a high-level, very professional, tapped-in person. And the Iranians interestingly matched it, as I have understood it, with a very high-level person from their Council of Guardians, which is a top group there, as Abe's counterpart. So they could go there and do their lawyering. But when they're through doing their lawyering, they could have additional discussions, and it was completely private. So we were able to conduct a private, very high-level discussion with Iran all through this period. And so you did that. And tell us what you learned about Iranian negotiating style. How would you, as a negotiator, you're accustomed to looking at the other guy and say, how does he go about things?
Well, the book ends with a couple of pages about Iranian negotiating style and whether there's differences of substance behind the negotiating style. Americans are sort of, I was born in India and I'm an immigrant. I'm used to a lot of negotiating styles. My family is Iraqi by background. So I'm an Arab Jew. I was born in India, a British subject. And I'm used to seeing a lot of differences in style. But, and there are differences. The Iranians, pretend to be your friends. And they kind of, they're obsequious to some degree. And they ask for 10 times more than they expect and offer 10 times less. It's a routine. It's like dealing with a rug merchant in the old city. It truly is. And it really requires all the patience that dealing with a rug merchant in the old city requires. You can say to the guy, you're asking for $10 when this thing's only worth $1, but that's not going to simplify the situation. He knows that. You have to go through the process of getting that price down from 10 to 1. And you start by offering 10 cents. I mean, you know, that's what happens. And he is outraged. It's feigned. And you are amused. And it goes on like that. And if you don't have the patience for it, don't do it. Because we've got lots of good diplomats in our State Department who do have the patience to do it. And we need to send people like that to talk to the Iranians because that's what's required. And they make agreements and they abide by the agreements they make when they make them. It's tough to get them to make agreements, but when they make agreements, they abide by them. Any comparison to the Soviet Union that would put the Iranians in a derogatory light is unjustified. And what Ronald Reagan said about the Soviet Union applies to the Iranians. Trust but verify. Same thing.
When you started, I thought you were going to say, not trust but verify, but evil empire.
Right.
And my colleague Paul Nitze was once called before a congressional committee, and they were very upset when President Reagan did that. And one of the senators wound up saying, Paul, how can you serve in an administration where the president calls the Soviet Union an evil empire? And Paul replied, Senator, have you considered the possibility that the statement might be accurate? Now, here's a little different kind of a question for you. It seems like the wild card of Iranian politics is the health of the supreme leader, Khomeini. He is old and his health is in question. How would his death affect the nuclear negotiations?
I don't think it would hurt much, George. He's really become a fierce hawk. I think that... But you don't know. I mean, one can't know who's going to take his place. When he took Khomeini's place, people were optimistic, and he was much more flexible then. He worked closely with Rafsanjani at the time. And Rafsanjani is a very practical but devoted Islamic political leader. I certainly don't wish him ill. But I think he's been very unconstructive. So I don't think it would hurt very much when he leaves the scene.
This goes back to Israel. Somebody's written here, many countries critique Israel. Why is the U.S. so set on stopping Jerusalem from taking unilateral action? Or are we?
Well, I have to be honest now. I think that most American national security experts oppose a preventive strike on Iran at this time. And I don't think it's a policy we have articulated in that way. But I think that it's a policy we believe in, and we are advising Israel to abide by that policy because we believe in it for ourselves as well. I don't think the U.S. will dictate to Israel in the final analysis. But I think the U.S. is justified in telling Israel what it thinks. And this is going to be a very dangerous thing to preventively attack Iran's nuclear facilities. It's going to be a huge job. There are over a dozen major facilities to attack. I know people say there's only two really important ones, but those two could be replaced. And the general feeling in the national security community in the United States, despite what the president has said publicly in maintaining that he has Israel's back, and I think he really means it. I think the fact of the matter is that the general sense in the national security community is that if we did attack preventively, we could set them back for a time, but they know how to make a bomb already. And if you read Cordesman's report 3 weeks ago and the Rand report 2 weeks ago, you will see a detailed description of all the things Iran knows how to do and has done. And all those are derived from the reports of the IAEA, which are highly reliable because they tend to understate what Iran has done rather than overstate it?
Here's a different kind of a question. It's very short. It says, what is Iran's goal? That is to say, some people think that Iran's goal is to create a different kind of a world and is trying to lead the world of Islam in that direction. That's their goal, and to think that they're going to shift their ground in any way is a mistake. That's what they're after, and they feel perfectly justified in using acts of terror or other kinetic means to achieve it. So what do you think their goal is?
Well, this is a classic statement, which happens to be true, that revolutionary regimes do not get talked out of their goals. They get forced out of their goals. And this is important to understand. The agreements that emerge from negotiations based on strength are not agreements that derive from changes of mind or purpose. They're agreements that derive from imposed necessity. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about negotiating from strength. Their goals are to get the West out of the Middle East completely and to have hegemony there, not only Islamic hegemony, but Shiite Islamic hegemony. So they are the leadership is very serious about those revolutionary objectives. And we are not going to talk them out of it. We have to force them out of it. And part of that is strength, and part of that is diplomacy. Serious diplomacy. Continuing diplomacy. Not the kind of rhetoric that we've had.
Well, let's set the stage a little bit more.
Okay.
Because strength, diplomacy, those are good words, and believe in them. But what we need to do to set up our strength, it can't be simply being ready to respond and attack some vulnerable place. I mentioned the energy area. It seems to me something doable if we were really roll up our sleeves and do something about it. And you get the price of oil down, and that's what they depend on. So why shouldn't we be working very hard on that as an element in our strength?
I agree completely. I think that that's one thing, and there are other things we've done that have improved our strength. I think the anti-missile defense programs that are being implemented in Eastern Europe and Israel in particular, where Israel is implementing three levels of anti-missile defense with the help of the United States. And there are things like that we can do and are doing to improve our strength vis-a-vis Iran. But when they do something specific to attack American soldiers, as they are in Afghanistan today, providing rockets that kill NATO soldiers to their favorite Taliban allies, that is intolerable. I don't think we should talk ourselves out of standing up to a state that's killing American soldiers.
All right, let's take that specific example. What would you do?
I would attack the delivery...
Where exactly?
Well, I'm sure that we know where those rockets are being made, how they're coming across the border, when shipments are actually made. I would take out those shipments. I would take out the rocket factories. I would send...
So there's no privileged sanctuary inside Iran. We don't hesitate to go inside.
The hesitation to go inside Iran has been a grave mistake, And it has given the IRGC enormous credibility within the Iranian political system, because they all say we can get away with murder. And they have.
So you're pretty convincing, I must say.
Thank you, sir.
Particularly when you look at me like that. Don't ask me another question. Well, do you think that in some ways we can effectively rally the Middle East countries? Look at they're in the turmoil right now. Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco maybe are taming down a little bit. Syria is. Why are we so hesitant about supporting what's going on in Syria? After all, Assad has been their ally. Syria has been the conduit for their weaponry to go to Hezbollah. Are you worried about Hezbollah?
Yes.
So why aren't we against Assad? What's the matter?
I think we are against Assad, and I think we're trying to bring Russia on board. And I get the feeling from Secretary Clinton that she very much wants to do more against Assad.
I mean, we've got to be specific here, Abe. You can't just say do more.
I think that's really something you probably should answer yourself. When I was on the secretary's team, he would assign certain things to each member of that team, and we knew what we were talking about in those areas. And this was not the area I was assigned.
Well, let me make a suggestion. You're my lawyer, and you tell me what to do. There are a lot of refugees in Syria. And Turkey has a clear interest and has done things. It's the only country that's actually done anything. And it's set up refugee areas where people can go. And it has, in effect, said that you can come here and you can plan and you can get your act together on the rebel side. That's expensive to do. So why don't we say to Turkey, we'll work with you. We're with you. We'll help provide material. We'll be there. And we're openly taking a position like that. How about that?
I think it's a great idea.
What kind of a legal advisor are you? You're going to give me all this mumbo jumbo?
No, on the one hand and on the other. None of that.
No, two-handed lawyer, huh?
No, sir.
Well, but the Middle East is in turmoil. So what do you think about that? And how isn't that going to have an impact on Iran? You sort of brushed off the possibility of the rebellion that took place in Iran, which I thought we were... We didn't try to support it at all, which was very disappointing
right.
to me.
Right.
But anyway, those people are still there, and there are a lot of things going on in other countries. So why are you so...
I think they would take heart from our being strong with Iran and from our being open with Iran. And really, the diplomatic agenda that I've laid out here is going to be very stunning to the Iranian people. If we really reached out to the Iranian people the way I've suggested tonight, it would be revolutionary in the impact it would have within Iran. I believe that.
So you're saying we should have this policy shift and we should announce it and describe it.
Absolutely.
And tell Iran specifically what's going to happen.
Absolutely, sir.
And if we do that, then we would have to follow through. I remember sometimes little things that happen to you make a big impact. But I was in World War II as a Marine, and I remember in boot camp, you enlist in the Marines and you think you're going to be a Marine, but you're not. You become a boot. And only if you make it out of boot camp do you become a Marine. Anyway, I remember a sergeant hands me my rifle, and he says, take good care of this rifle. This is your best friend. And remember, never point this rifle at anybody unless you're willing to pull the trigger. No empty threats. So if we're going to announce this policy that you're advocating, It better not be an empty threat, or we just go down the drain. Our credibility is shot.
Absolutely.
So that means there needs to be a lot of work done to be sure that we can deliver on what we say. And I don't mean just technically, militarily. Our armed forces can execute. We know that. We saw this demonstration of the SEALs with Osama bin Laden. It was breathtaking. So our military is there for us, but we have to be sure that they have firm support and build it. So how are you going to go about that?
If our political leaders were to take a firm position on strength and diplomacy with Iran along the lines I've described, which basically is the Schultz approach to strength and diplomacy.
You say anything to get me to agree with
no.
it.
Look, I mean, I've been hanging around for 20 years. Some of it's sunk in. if that happened, we've got fabulous military people and diplomats ready to implement this kind of a program. I have no doubt about it. I mean, the latest diplomat that was engaged in that stuff is Jim Dobbins, who knows how to do it. He talked to the Iranians. They agreed to a number of very important things when we went into Afghanistan, and Jim brought about those agreements. And there are people like Jim who are in the State Department or who have been in the State Department who are available. We have Mike Armacost here tonight, and we've got a guy like Chet Crocker, who I quote in my book about the meaning and the purpose of negotiations, and Roz Ridgway, who was, you know, a star in the Soviet era. I think, Mr. Secretary, you know more than anybody, having been the boss of those people, that they know how to do it. They just need to be given the word. And they can do it. They can transform this relationship, which is what we need to do. We need to transform this relationship. We have no relationship with Iran. And there's no reason for that. They're good people. They're intelligent people. They have a fabulous history. Don't just make a speech about it. Implement real change, and there will be real consequences.
This meeting is about to come to a close, and I see that I have the signal. There are only 2 minutes left. So it's an opportunity for you to say something brief that you think encapsulates what you're trying to get across here. And as soon as you finish, I will read out the last things I'm supposed to read.
Well, thank you, Mr. Secretary. It's a privilege to be here at the Commonwealth Club to talk about this complicated subject. It truly is complicated. We face alternatives that are both extremely undesirable. I've put out some ideas based on the concepts of strength and diplomacy that I hope will stir things up a little bit because they can be improved on. I know how ideas get improved. Once they get into the mill of American strategists thinking and the State Department and the Department of Defense and the White House, we could develop new ideas to deal with this Iranian problem. We should not be locked in to this option of preventive attack or a nuclear-armed Iran. And we don't have to be. And I would like to see this country, read the book. I'd like to see this country move away from this kind of either-or thinking into a more complicated, definitely more complicated, but much more fruitful engagement.
Abe, you have given us a lot of material to think about carefully. It's extremely important to get this right and think it through. And our thanks go to Abraham Safir. distinguished scholar and senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, and author of the new book, Taking on Iran. And the book is available on the internet at Scribler.com, whatever that means. Today's program has been underwritten by the Corrett and Taube Family Foundations. I'm George Schultz, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Good work. Excellent.
Thank you. I think you...